Rod Oram, good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
That is a very significant majority for an incoming Labor government, which does not need, but will have some kind of relationship with the Greens. What will it face coming in terms of the economic stresses, and what is this going to mean also for its business policies?
Let me start with the economic outlook. We're obviously far from being out of the woods yet, and certainly there are sectors, particularly tourism and related ones such as airlines, hotels, hospitality, etc., which are still in deep trouble. And there's no doubt there's still more economic and business damage yet to surface. But overall, the economy is tracking really quite well. So the sort of forecasts that are coming out of economists about the third quarter growth, which is almost at an end, is about an 8 to 10% growth. And that's, of course, after the 12.2% fall in the second quarter. It's a bit too early to predict the fourth quarter. But however, we'd have to be going into the end of this year and into next with a rather more confidence about how the economy is going to track than would have seemed earlier in the year. And then the other side of this is the Reserve Bank, of course, is very active. Its next program, which it will be announcing the details of shortly, we've only seen the outline, is called Funding for Lending. And that's to ensure banks have plenty of money to lend. But quite fascinatingly, they've actually got a great deal of money to lend, but nobody's borrowing it. So at the moment, there hasn't been an increase in borrowing it. There's still borrowing going on. So if you look back at their balance sheets pre-COVID in February, they had about $16 billion of cash on their balance sheet. But now they have over $40 billion. So the big question from that economic front is, and it's kind of a chicken and egg thing about when business has enough confidence to borrow more and invest more. And that will be one of the key things to watch out for. And then, of course, another really important part of the program is to make sure the small business cash flow loan scheme keeps working, keeps developing, and indeed gets a better pickup than it's had, because that's going to be really important to how the economy tracks from here.
So do we just touch a little more on what the Reserve Bank is doing with lending to banks, by the way? This is a new mechanism, is it not?
Yes, it's a variation on quantitative easing. So quantitative easing so far has been the Reserve Bank in effect creating money on its balance sheet and then buying bonds from investors. And then if the sellers happen to be banks, that cash then ends up on their balance sheets. So they've now got more money to lend. So the concern was always that the banks have strong balance sheets and are ready to do more heavy lifting. But the question here is, with funding for lending, that's now taking that directly to the banks rather than that circuitous route. The other tool that is really important to watch here is the very limited scope the Reserve Bank has to act via interest rates. So the official cash rate that it charges banks for borrowing money overnight from it is almost zero. The Reserve Bank has signaled it could go to zero into minus territory next year. But even if it did, whilst that might go to zero, for the bank's customers, both in terms of those people who deposit money with the banks, but also people who borrow from the banks, those interest rates are not likely to go to zero. That has happened in some countries, and it's by no means an economic drama. But the current thought amongst economists here that interest rates would still remain in positive territory, albeit mortgages might come down to slightly under, for example, 2%. They're almost there now, which would, of course, would be very, I was going to say, supportive of the housing market. It might cause a bit even more pressure on the housing market in terms of people chasing after properties when both in mortgages are so low, interest rates are expected to stay low for a long time, and inflation is expected to remain low.
What of some of the policies that are going to most affect the business sector?
Let me start here with a big theme. So what we've been seeing from the business associations of various kinds, Business New Zealand, the Employers and Manufacturers Association, Chambers of Commerce, for example, has very much focused on some particular things, very much around the workplace, for example. And I'll come back to those in a moment. What they're not commenting on is the big strategic things that Labour is very determined to do. And quite obviously the biggest is to really put some policies in place on climate change so that we start using the Zero Carbon Act framework, the Climate Change Commission and all it's up to, and a now fit for purpose emissions trading scheme much more effectively to actually start reducing emissions. So that's why, in terms of the government's program, I think that's a really important thing to focus on. I would say it's the top thing. So the Climate Change Commission is on a very tight deadline. It's been pushed out a bit because of COVID. But by May the 31st, it has to propose to government draft versions of its first 3 5-year carbon budgets. So those will be sinking budgets that take us on the road ultimately to net zero emissions by 2050, which is the intent of the legislation. But, and then it'll also propose draft pathways to achieve them. Now, the government, well, there'll be a chance for public submissions on that. It'll be a very short time, as it always is in our parliament, so people are going to have to be really busy during that, I think, only about a six-week period, to feed back to the government. And then the government has to decide by the end of next year what budgets it's going to commit to and then I stress those are falling budgets for carbon over 15 years, and then what the pathways are. So that's where the real work on emissions reduction happens. So that's going to be incredibly important to look to next year. And of course, it has to be, you know, a signature, oh, what a horrible phrase, a fundamentally important set of policies from the Prime Minister's point of view, given her stated views on climate change and now a mandate to do more. But then so many other issues flow on from that, and I'll just highlight a few of them. The first one is in electricity, where the biggest single issue is what the government will decide about the Lake Onslow pumped hydro storage scheme, which it's very keen on, in the face of some quite stiff opposition from quite a few people in the electricity sector and more widely across the economy. Rod Carr, the chair of the Climate Commission, has reiterated just in the last sort of 24, 48 hours, that New Zealand has to solve the problem of dry years in electricity generation, which is what Lake Onslow is about. But there is a big debate whether the investment in Lake Onslow is a sensible one and what the alternatives might be. So that's a huge issue for next year, or for the rest of this year and into next year. But the second one I'd highlight is what's going on in agriculture. So as you'll no doubt remember, where we're at with agriculture is that the primary sector proposed a mechanism, the government agreed last term, on what's known as the Primary Sector Climate Action Partnership, or it goes by its Māori sort of tagline of He Waka Eke Noa, you know, we're all in this together. Now, that work's underway. My sense of how that preliminary work's going is encouraging, where the working parties are trying to work out how to measure, price and manage agricultural emissions on the road to that great goal of reducing emissions. Now, the working group itself has a 2025 deadline to achieve all that. But the government said right at the outset of that process that it wants to see really good progress during 2020, and it's only just got going late in this year, and then 2021. And if it deems there is insufficient progress, the threat was, I don't know whether the government would act on the threat, to bring agriculture very gently into the ETS as early as 2022. So that's a huge thing to watch. But I want to stress there that I'm actually rather more positive in recent months about what's going on around those climate issues in the primary sector. I think that's a very useful pathway they're on, compared with electricity and all sorts of other things.
All right, so that's a big one. And also, of course, we've got, what are the sort of the flow-on effects from the targets we're facing over climate change, by the way? We've, of course, got some companies exposed through the ETS already, but is that another situation that is just going to become more and more prominent over time?
Yes. I think there's a genuine effort by many major and smaller businesses to do work on this. So, for example, the Climate Leaders Coalition, which is a group of some 120 companies, most of them are some of our biggest, but some smaller ones in there too, which are very committed as organizations to work on their own emissions. And there's a discipline and requirements around that within the group to have the policy and government programs to help them in that. So there's a strong advocate in that. They also, in the meantime, have confidence that if they're trade exposed in terms of their exporters or they're very energy intensive or a combination of the two or emissions intensive, then they get free allocations of credits and therefore they're not disadvantaged versus their competitors overseas. So there's that backstop. But alongside that backstop is the recognition that there has to be progress. So I think overall, there is a reasonable degree of focus in the business sector on climate change. But then we start broadening out into a whole bunch of other environmental and ecosystem legislation reforms, of which the replacing the Resource Management Act is absolutely top of the list. And of course, lots of people want it changed, but there was or dropped and something new in designed in its place. But then there was a great difference in the election campaign between the positions of the parties. So Labour is very keen, it was very clear that it's going to keep in that environmental legislation, environmental requirements and bottom lines closely, directly linked with planning and resource consent. But the idea is to make the RMA, or what was the RMA, more effective by splitting into two separate bills. And this is all from the Randerson report, which was a very good report on how to reform the RMA, keeping at the heart a lot of the RMA case law and precedent. So this is not a clean slate. But dividing it into a Natural and Built Environments Act and then a Strategic Planning Act that would sit alongside it. And then what the government hasn't talked about is that if you're going down that Strategic Planning Act, where you're trying to get spatial planning across far bigger, more logical divisions of the country rather than within this mosaic of local governments, you would probably have to look at some form of local government amalgamation as well. On top of that, there's much more work to come on freshwater reforms. That's all laid out. And also progress, for example, on the government's biodiversity strategy. So there's been very good groundwork in the first term on all of those issues. So this needs to be a very big delivery term for getting this through, with obviously a successor to the RMA and an improvement on it as the number one issue.
What about some of the big industry, the big sectors and their issues?
The one that I think best articulated is the primary sectors, and that's come through from the Primary Sector Council, which was of industry leaders, which was created by this government in its first term, and then it delivered its draft report late last year, and then its final report and the government's endorsement of that came about mid this year, about June, as memory serves. And that's very articulate. we do need some industry strategies elsewhere, and that's been much slower work. And I'd hope there will be more on that, because there's a whole bunch of pressing issues. So the most obvious one is those big legacy assets from generations ago at a time of high energy consumption, commodity exports, and high emissions. So I'm talking here about the aluminium smelter. I'll come back to emissions in aluminium if you'd like me to. A lot of the emissions are actually upstream in the mining and refining it into bauxite before it finally gets to our smelter. But then the refinery up at Marsden Point, and then New Zealand Steel. So all three of those sectors globally are experiencing extraordinary turmoil and change. Therefore, those three entities are really struggling to maintain a competitive role in their global sectors. So I think that's going to be a very important focus for the government in how it works with business on achieving some real progress for them, which may or may not include them ultimately continuing to produce, but at least finding a way for them to do as much as they can in the years to come.
Also, some concerns being raised out of business over the fair pay agreements and the likelihood that they will now accelerate. What can we expect?
Well, again, another big commitment by Labour in the campaign to fair pay agreements. And the work on that was very slow in the first term and hadn't really come to fruition. And so these would be occupation or sector specific agreements on minimum employment standards, such as wages, redundancies, overtime and the like. And that would be agreed in bargaining, that those terms be agreed, but in bargaining between affected workers and employers, and then become a part of the legal requirement in that sector. So business is still very, very, well, ranging from being fiercely opposed to being very concerned about all this. There is some support out there. It depends on the sector, but not a great deal. Meanwhile, business lobby groups have been tending to focus, and this has been coming through during the campaign and since the election results on Saturday, of focusing very much on individual aspects of like this, such as the advisability of or not of lifting the minimum wage next April to $20 from $18.90 currently, or adding another 5 days of sick leave to the current level of five. Now, I just want to emphasize that's an astonishingly low level of sick leave by international standards, those 5 days. So turning it up, putting it out to 10 is still low by many country standards, but obviously business looks at that as a cost because they're paying somebody when they're not working. Then, of course, there's another public holiday mooted, Matariki, and then 4 weeks compulsory redundancy pay. So, and on top of all that, the Holiday Act has always been a mess, very complicated. All sorts of people screw up their calculations on that, including the government, famously, in various areas. So there's a lot of agreement in business and government that the Holiday Act needs a big revamp. And then on top of all that, you've got, sorry, I'm not laughing nervously or in any way critical of this. I think this is a good thing. We've got the future of work tripartite efforts that grew out of Grant Robertson's future of work efforts in opposition. And this brings together business unions and governments trying to make sense or trying to make progress on what does work mean these days in terms of where technology and the economy is going, and how do we work together on that? Interestingly, that tripartite work kept going all the way through pretty intense times during lockdown, although it tended to be just a very focused conversation between the business union and government leaders on that. But that's also important to watch over these next 3 years, because in many ways that gives us some of the overarching work that we need to make work and skills, you know, help them to make huge progress.
A lot of speculation as to whether some of Labor's majority is the result of national voters wanting them to govern alone rather than govern with the Greens. No matter, they don't need the Greens. What's it going to mean, in your view, for the relationship between Labor and the Greens with respect to business? What's the impact for business?
Well, it's going to be completely fascinating to see where the negotiations between them land. My view on this is that what Labour has been proposing is reasonable in many respects, but it's insufficiently ambitious. So if you then turn to the Green Party's manifesto, you see across a number of areas where they are more articulate, and more future focused, but particularly on the concept of how do you stimulate economic recovery in such a way that is economically beneficial right away, but then is helping to reorient the economy in these directions, particularly obviously around the journey to a low emissions economy. So if you look at their top six policy priorities, they are future of transport, farming for the future, progressive tax reform, homes for all, clean energy plan, and thriving oceans. And if you look within all of those, there are a number of things that you could pick up on. Let me just go straight to the tax one, for example, because the Prime Minister's made it very clear that there's no going revisiting capital gains, and there's no way they're going to talk about a welfare tax. But if you go back to the Cullen report on tax from its working group, there's still a great deal of recommendations there which need to be picked up. I mean, one of them, for example, is environmental taxes, because the whole concept of taxing things which are not good for the economy and not good for the environment is a good thing, especially if you can lighten up in some way on good things like profits and wages and everything else. And then similarly, in the welfare working groups report, again, in the first term, the government only picked up a bit of that. So there's a lot more that could be picked up on from both those, which would take us into a rather more ambitious territory, not full reform. So that would be one example. But then you can look down housing, farming in particular. The Greens are very supportive of a shift to regenerative agriculture. Sorry, I won't unpack that term right now, but it's a wonderful term about working to ensure that ecosystems become more resilient, more productive. And therefore, in addition to that, the Greens, for example, are proposing new rules to encourage a shift away from monoculture plantations of radiata pine and to ensure more productive land is kept in food production rather than going off into radiata pine trees. So there's a bunch of stuff there in the Greens manifesto that could be picked up by a government. If it wants to give the Greens a bit of a go in government. And then what also leads on to that is that despite a very large caucus, the government is going to need some ministerial talent. And there's obviously talent there in James Shaw in particular as co-leader, particularly on climate. I think he could handily also do energy as well, and that would be a good combination. But Marama Davidson, Eugenie Sage and Julianne Genta have all demonstrated in roles that they could do more. And of course, I think a really interesting person would be Chloe Swarbrick, who has demonstrated in her first term in Parliament before this election a really good head for policy and some deep knowledge, keen interest in some areas. And I think it'd be very interesting if she had a junior portfolio in one of the areas that she's strong in.
Thank you, Rod Oram, business commentator.